Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, a conversation with Thomas Frank. On Friday, March 24th, author Thomas Frank came to Bloomington to promote his book entitled Listen, Liberals. Frank talked about the modern Democratic Party, the essence of its philosophy, and how it has changed over the years. Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas?, Pity the Billionaire, and The Wrecking Crew, along with many others. The lecture took place at the IU School of Education, and Democracy for Monroe County hosted the lecture. We begin today's lecture with Thomas Frank taking the floor.
Folks, I want to talk about the country that just elected Donald Trump president. The last few years have been a time of brisk prosperity here in America, at least according to official measurements. Unemployment is down, the stock market is up, and I mean it's up, way up. For people who work for a living, however, nothing ever seems to improve. Wages do not grow in this country anymore. The median household income today is still well below where it was in 2007. What the economists have a term for, the labor share of the gross national product, the share of the what we produce that is taken by workers instead of by management, by stockholders. And the labor share of the gross national product hit its all-time low in 2011 and then stayed there all through the next couple of years. In 2014, towards the end of 2014, with the stock market at all-time highs, it did a poll that showed that three-quarters of the American public thought the economy was still in recession. And the reason they thought that was because for them, it was. Now, once upon a time, your average American could be counted upon to know whether things were going up in this country or things were going down. And the reason was because when America prospered, the American people prospered too. But these days, things are different. I want to look at it in a statistical way. If you go from the middle of the 1930s, from the Great Depression up to 1980, what you'll see is that the lower 90% of the population in this country, a group we might call the American people, in that period, that group took home 70% of the growth in the country's income. If you know, that's as it should be, right? The vast majority of people should reap the rewards of prosperity. If you look at the same numbers starting in 1997 up to now, from the height of the dot-com bubble up until today, you'll find that this same group, the American people, pocketed none of the country's income growth. Their share in these great good times was zero. The upper 10% of the population, by which I mean the country's financiers and managers and professionals, consumed the whole thing. To be a young person in America, and here we are on the campus of Indiana University, to be a young person in this country is to understand instinctively the downward slope that so many of us are on these days. College costs are out of control. The university where I got my PhD back in the 1990s today costs nearly $65,000 a year to attend. You go there for 4 years, that's more than $250,000. And you want to go to a school like that, you're going to take out a lot of loans. And as I travel this country, I am forever meeting young people who are $100,000 in debt, okay? Student loan debt. They are starting life $100,000 in debt. They're going out into this Uberized economy that we live in with the equivalent of a mortgage and no house to show for it. Now, at the other end of the social ladder, of course, it's all upside all the time. Back in 1980, American CEOs made about 40 times as much as their average line worker. Today, it's 373 times. One particularly lucky American family has so much wealth. Well, they have as much as 40% of the population put together. The main accomplishment of the high-achieving individuals who make up this family, The main accomplishment of theirs was to inherit shares in Walmart, the retailer that has sucked the life out of the towns in the part of the country that I come from. And that's where we are, folks, almost 10 years after the financial crisis. Growth that doesn't grow and prosperity that doesn't prosper. The country, we understand now, is simply no longer arranged in such a way as to make its citizens economically secure. And that's the country that elected Donald Trump president. The middle class is disintegrating, folks, in the great middle class nation. And you know this is true. There is outrage and fury around every corner. I used to study history. That was my subject when I got that PhD. And you would expect these developments that I've just described to lead to a revival of the left. That's what happened at similar times in history in the 1890s, in the 1930s. And here's the thing that gets me. This is what just absolutely drives me crazy about this age that we're living in. This period of inequality, the politics are dominated by right-wing revolts that only accelerate the disintegration of the middle class. One after another after another. It's Trump right now, but in my lifetime there have been, well, depending on how you count it, 5 successful conservative uprisings, beginning with Nixon, you know, then in the late 70s, you know, the New Right, Ronald Reagan, Gingrich, George W. Bush, Tea Party movement, you know, and now Trump. And what's funny is that while all of these things keep happening, the pundits keep declaring that the conservative era is at an end. And yet it keeps chugging along. Okay, to understand how, I'm sorry, this is depressing stuff, and it's going to get even worse as we go along, okay? But this is the world we're living in, folks. And I want to illustrate it by reminding you what things were like in 2009. I want to keep going back to that year. I think it was pivotal. That was the year, you know, of the bank bailouts. The Great Recession was getting going, and the financial crisis had happened the previous year. And all of these things seemed to discredit the philosophy of free markets. It seemed like they discredited the philosophy of free markets for good. You know, the philosophy of our modern-day Republican Party. We had deregulated Wall Street. We had, you know, laid down and worshipped at the feet of Wall Street. We had put nice, friendly Wall Streeters in charge of overseeing Wall Street, and then Wall Street went and poisoned the economy of the entire world with its, you know, mortgage-backed securities. And so 2009 seemed like a turning point. This seemed like the moment when change might come. You know, George W. Bush and his gang of hacks and cronies had blundered into all of these disasters. The Iraq War, Hurricane Katrina, remember the Jack Abramoff scandal, and then the financial crisis, economic catastrophe. You know, it's the last straw. I live in Washington these days, and the wise men of Washington thought they understood what was happening. And they said the sort of tectonic plates of politics were shifting here. And conservatism's long reign was at an end. A historian wrote that the age of Reagan was finally over. The liberal age of Obama was dawning. The pendulum had swung one way, and now it was going to swing back the other just by force of gravity. There was nothing we had to do about that. It was just that's how things worked. Now, back in 2009, some of these pundits in Washington, they loved to talk about how the Republican Party was on a political suicide mission. This was a favorite pundit image at the time. How its candidates had zero chance in the enlightened new America we were living in. The Republicans were being sent to the dustbin of history. It's exactly the same thing we heard last year. Exactly. With commentator after commentator insisting that Trump had no chance at all and that the Republicans had destroyed themselves by nominating him. Now, back in 2009, the Republicans, turns out they weren't interested in their own demise. And they refused to take the advice of the pundit corps. And in fact, they did the exact opposite of what everyone expected them to do. And they stepped on the gas instead of the brakes. Instead of moving to the center, like everyone was advising them to do, they purged their moderates. And they responded to the failure of markets by becoming free market zealots. And then in 2010, this radicalized Republican Party scored its greatest victory in congressional elections in many decades. They took 600 seats from Democrats at the state level. They purged countless Republican moderates. In 2014, they took the Senate, and today the tragedy is complete. They control the presidency, Congress, the Supreme Court, and the most state legislatures since the 1920s. This is a wipeout for the Democratic Party, and also for those pundits who have so persistently taken Democratic Party victory for granted. And all of this is going on, remember, while Wall Street loots the world and the middle class falls apart. 12 years ago, I wrote a book about populist conservatism in my home state, Kansas. And I had a phrase in that book that I was proud of. I said that in Kansas, the gravity of discontent pulls to the right, and to the right, and further to the right. The gravity of discontent. And when I wrote that, I was trying to describe what I saw out in Kansas as something weird, right? An aberration. It's like, look what's going on in the, you know, heart of darkness, the heart of America, you know? Today, folks, the gravity of discontent works that way everywhere in this country, everywhere you go. Frankly, it works that way everywhere in the world. Marine Le Pen, I mean, look at England, look at Hungary, look at Spain. It was Holland just the other day. This is happening everywhere you go. Why is this happening? Why does it work this way now? Why does the gravity of discontent pull to the right? To stick with our own country, one reason is because the Republicans are very comfortable with the traditional language of populism, which is a language of class grievance, of class anger. They're very comfortable with it. They use it all the time. They rail against the elite and the rigged system that we live under, and they complain about Hollywood millionaires, and the arrogant people that make our TV shows, and the haughty professors who indoctrinate our children. And they pretend to love ordinary Americans, right? The people they call the real Americans who live in the place they call the heartland. And this is what's really fascinating. They deliberately mimic left-wing protest movements from days of yore. They deliberately mimic that. That's what the Tea Party movement was, okay? It's a fake 1930s protest movement. Glenn Beck, remember him? He was the great hero of 2009, or everybody was, he was a superstar then. And he deliberately mimicked Martin Luther King's March on Washington. Do you remember this? Paul Ryan, who's now the Speaker of the House back in that year, wrote an article in Forbes magazine that he called Down with Big Business. Paul Ryan wrote that. And now here comes Trump. America's blue-collar billionaire is what they called him. Yeah, that's what they called him at the Republican convention last summer in Cleveland. And if you listen to his speech then, this is sort of the high point for him, his speech at the Republican convention. And he pledged himself to the working class voters left behind by the current recovery. This is what he said. It's striking. I have visited the laid off factory workers and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals. And this is what comes next. This is an unmistakable echo of Franklin Roosevelt. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, people who work hard but no longer have a voice. And then he tried to flip on its head the usual criticism that people like us, make of conservatives, that they're pawns of the Koch brothers, that sort of thing. Here's what he said. Big business, elite media, and major donors are lining up behind the campaign of my opponent because they know she will keep our rigged system in place. And a line he stole from Elizabeth Warren. That's right. They are throwing money at her, meaning Hillary, because they have total control over every single thing she does. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings. You see this? It's all just repurposed stuff from our side. Everything he said. Now, Donald Trump is a hypocrite and a vulgarian and a bigot. But when he said those things, he connected emotionally. When he said the system was rigged, yeah, it is. He's right about that. He's right when he pointed out that huge parts of the country had been deindustrialized. And that's a terrible thing. What is absolutely crazy about this is that those are things my side used to say. Those are things that Democrats used to say. Speaking of Democrats, just the other day I opened up the Washington Post and saw a picture of Donald Trump laying a wreath at the grave of Andrew Jackson, founder of the Democratic Party. And the first, our country's first champion of populism. The populist style basically begins with Jackson. Here's Trump, the founder of the Democratic Party. And he's like, yeah, that's me now.
You have been listening to A Conversation with Thomas Frank on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Listening to author Thomas Frank give a lecture on his book tour for his book entitled Listen Liberals. Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Pity the Billionaire, and The Wrecking Crew, among with many others. Frank was brought to Bloomington on March 24th by Democracy for Monroe County. We return now to Frank talking about where Democrats are in protecting the middle class.
So where are the Democrats in all of this? Where are the actual heirs of Andrew Jackson? You know, once upon a time, when I was younger, I mean, protecting the middle class society, that was a no-brainer for Democrats. That's who they were. That's what this party was all about. You know, and they wouldn't shut up about it. I mean, Democrats wanted everyone to understand that that was their identity. Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, I mean, these guys would have taken one look at what Wall Street is doing to the country now, and they would have swung directly into action. They would have known exactly what to do. But our modern Democratic leaders, most of them anyways, falter. They understand that inequality is a terrible thing, and they cry big, hot tears about it, but they cannot find the conviction or the imagination to do what is necessary to put this thing into reverse. And instead, they dish up the same high-minded policy platitudes that they have been dealing us since the 1980s. They tell us there's nothing anybody can do about technology, right? Nothing you can do about that. Nothing you can do about globalization. They love that word, globalization, right? You can't, nothing you can do about that. That's the hand of God Almighty reaching down into human affairs and reorganizing our lives just however the invisible hand of God sees fit. That's what globalization is. And you know what the Democrats do? And they promise us charter schools and job training, and they'll shovel out the student loans. And other than that, folks, they've got nothing. Now, the example of this that I want to focus on is also from 2009. I want to keep things neat. We'll stay with everything, things that happened in 2009, the same year that the pundits were declaring the Republican Party to be dead. And the issue I want to talk about tonight is the Wall Street bailouts. And the reason I want to talk about that is because that's the turning point. That was the historical inflection point where this country could easily have changed direction. You know, this was the most important moment of this stupid century that we're living in, okay? This was the turning point, and folks, we missed the turn. Remember what it was like, okay? Barack Obama, elected president in a massive wave of hope and enthusiasm, and I was one of the hopeful ones, and he had the country at his back. He had the world at his back, and he steps into the White House and proceeds to continue the policies of President of George Bush towards Wall Street, basically unchanged. No big banks got put into receivership. No bailouts got unwound. No senior bankers got fired. He did fire the chairman of General Motors, but not Goldman. No, no. not Citibank, you know. Nobody got prosecuted either, even though the fraud was self-evident on the face of it. Now, they prosecuted lots of little people. If you lied on a mortgage application back in the last decade, yeah, they come after you. But not if you packaged those mortgages up into a security and sold it to retirees in Germany. No, 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 that's okay. That's quite all right. So Obama and his Democrats failed to change course, or refused to change course, when every sign was telling them to turn, when it would have been good for the country, I mean healthy economically, for us to be shed of Wall Street, when it was fully within their power to make that turn, when it was would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn. I mean, the country was behind him. And lastly, when everyone expected him to make that turn. And when I say everyone, I mean the bankers themselves. There's this moment in his almost exactly 8 years ago today when Barack Obama invited the Wall Street bankers down to the White House from New York, and they come down and they go into the meeting with him, and they are ashen-faced. And they know what's going to happen to them. They're going to get taken to the woodshed. And they come out of the meeting a couple hours later, and it's all smiles. You know, nothing changed. Instead, the administration foamed the runways for them, in the immortal words of Treasury Secretary Geithner. Foam the runways for the banks. Now, why? Why did Barack Obama play the greatest issue of them all the way that he did? It wasn't because the working class rallied around its friends on Wall Street. And it wasn't because he didn't have the power. The presidency is an enormously powerful office, as we're finding out every day when we open up the newspaper. Folks, Barack Obama played this issue the way he did back in 2009 because that's the way he wanted to play it. We have to understand that if we want to come to grips with what's wrong with the Democratic Party. That's how he wanted to do it. But in truth, that only pushes the problem back a little bit. I mean, this doesn't start with Barack Obama. Just saying he wants to do it doesn't explain why he wanted to do it. If we want to understand why he chose to act as he did, we have to do a little history. We have to go back to the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s. And back in those days, you might remember, the Democratic Party was engaged in a kind of civil war all the time. Different factions in the party fighting with each other constantly, fighting like cats and dogs, but they always agreed on one thing. There was one thing they all came together on, all of these different reform factions, and that was that the Democratic Party had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal with its fixation on working class people. They fought over everything else, but that was the one thing everyone knew, everyone in Washington knew that had to happen. And what Democrats had to embrace instead, they said, was the emerging post-industrial economy and the people that the Democratic Party needed to identify itself with were the winners in this coming new economic order. The winners, okay? The highly educated professionals who inhabit our innovative knowledge industries. And when I say professionals, you know what are the traditional professional groups, lawyers, doctors, architects, clergy, that sort of thing. But today, it's an enormous category. It's grown enormously. It's everybody with an advanced degree. It includes math PhDs who write derivative securities. It includes biochemists who make prescription drugs. All these different, it's an enormous category of people. And if you go back to the 1950s, this group, professionals, was one of the most solidly Republican groups in America. Today, it's one of the most Democratic groups. It's completely changed sides. And with them has gone the Democratic Party, the identity of the Democratic Party. So what I'm saying is that, and this is the thesis of Listen Liberal, that the Democrats, the way to think about our modern day Democrats is as a class party. Just like in the 19th century where, you know, like in France or something, each social class had its own party. They are a class party. It's just not the working class. The class they care about are these highly educated, white-collar professionals. I mean, they have other constituencies, as we all know, lots of people in the Democratic tent, minorities, women, and the young, of course, and many others. But professionals are the ones who come first. They're the ones who are sitting in the driver's seat in this party. And it's their tastes and manners that are celebrated by liberal newspapers. It's their particular way of regarding the world that's always taken for granted by Democratic politicians as being objectively, you know, and obviously true. So the Democratic Party may have started as a populist movement. In fact, it did start as a populist movement. But today, it's kind of the opposite of that. It is a movement of winners and the highly credentialed. And Democrats have all of these wonderful, flattering phrases for their favorite demographic group, these terms of endearment. They call these high-achieving professionals wired workers who will inherit the future. They're supposed to be a creative class. That you've heard this one, right? The creative class. They naturally rebel against fakeness and conformity. You know this. You're supposed to reorganize your city to make the creative class feel at home. You're supposed to write trade deals in order to make the creative class wealthy. They call them a learning class that truly gets the power of education, and best of all, an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new things. And of course, Democratic leaders themselves are always drawn exclusively from the ranks of this group. Not always, but these days they are. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton, if you look at their biographies, there's a striking similarity. They're all plucked from these lives of obscurity by fancy schools. And the time that they spend at fancy schools is what defines them as individuals. Like Bill Clinton, kid from Hot Springs, Arkansas, goes to Georgetown, Rhodes Scholar, Yale Law School, and the doors of the world open up for him. This is what defines him as an individual. And their cabinet choices are the same also. It's always these Ivy League types, you know, highly successful professionals whose worth is established by what they did in college, in grad school. So I'm going to summarize. This is what they think. Professionals are a kind of magical class, the heroes of history. The sort of, you know, like in Marx, you have proletariat that stands at the end of history as the winner, you know, in the dialectic. Democrats have a similar theory, only it's the professional class. They're the ones who stand at the, you know, at the end of this debased dialectic of innovation and creativity. They also happen to be this is their vision of history and of, you know, of society. And they're the number one constituency of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic leaders themselves are always drawn from this group. So you see what I'm getting at here. It's a complete change, a complete shift of allegiance from working class, middle class people to the professional class. And this is, I think, what explains everything that is, or most of the things that are so frustrating about our modern day Democrats. I mean, how do you get into a situation like we're in today, where inequality is growing, where we are headed back to a 19th century sort of income distribution, and the party of the left can't take advantage of it? I mean, where the party of the left is in a state of historic defeat, where the middle class is disintegrating and people are turning to a mountebank like Donald Trump? This is only possible, folks, when the party of the left isn't interested in its historic mission. That's the only way you get this combination of inequality and defeat. But why aren't they interested? Let's go back to the problem of Obama and the banks, the problem of 2009. Why did his team fail to do what so obviously needed to be done with these banks? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were actually going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary criminals? And they did declare this. The guy who said it had to resign, but he said it. He was a very high official at the Justice Department. Why did this administration choose Wall Street over average people again and again and again and again? Why? Because for the achievement-conscious people who were in the Obama administration, investment bankers were more than friends. These guys are classmates. And I mean that in both senses of the term. These guys are peers. These guys are the face in the mirror. You know, the two groups are the same, the Treasury Department, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citibank, whatever. People go back and forth through the revolving door. There's no difference. The, you know, Justice Department looks at Wall Street. They see people with subtle minds, you know, extraordinary innovativeness, you know, financial derivatives, financial innovation, and then this sophisticated jargon. And God, they love that. You know what I'm talking about? Wall Street makes up this jargon deliberately opaque, right, to disguise what they're doing. And these people in the Justice Department are like, God, that's profound. So they look at Wall Street and they see exactly the kind of creative individuals that Democratic Party theory tells us we must honor and respect. Okay, the worst anecdote of the evening. I was reading an article in Fortune magazine about 3 months before the election, and it was an interview with Barack Obama. And the magazine asked him what he wanted to do in his post-presidency, and one of the things that he said was venture capital. This is the man we hired to get tough with Wall Street, and he wants to go through the revolving door himself. And why not, right? They look at these, they look at Wall Street, these people plucking wealth out of thin air, making these financial instruments that are so wonderful, so complex, slicing and dicing risk. It's like financial rocket science, as a different Justice Department official said. And by the way, he said that as an explanation for why they couldn't prosecute these guys. Financial rocket science, dude, no one gets it. It's beyond, it's on another level. Complexity, man. And it's exactly the same for Big Pharma. You know, they look at Big Pharma, it's so innovative. You can't import generic pharmaceuticals from Canada or India or something. No, 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 no. You have to protect Eli Lilly. You have to protect Pfizer. And folks, mega dittos for Silicon Valley. I mean, an industry that can do no wrong in Democratic eyes. You know, so lovable. Think of Mark Zuckerberg, right? So professional, think of Hillary's friend, Eric Schmidt. So creative that for this one industry, enforcement of our country's antitrust laws was basically suspended. Just for this one bunch of guys.
You have been listening to A Conversation with Thomas Frank on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Listening to author Thomas Frank give a lecture on his book tour for his book entitled Listen Liberals. Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Pity the Billionaire, and The Wrecking Crew, among with many others. Frank was brought to Bloomington on March 24th by Democracy for Monroe County. We now return to Frank asking the audience what exactly the Democratic Party believes in.
So what is a party, the party I'm describing, what do they believe in? What is their, what's their political philosophy? Well, the most important item on the list is meritocracy, the idea that the successful deserve their rewards and that the people on top in our society are up there because they are the best, okay? This is the first commandment of the professional class. Everyone gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. Okay? So the solution for inequality, the only solution for inequality is to go to a really top-ranked college, right? So they go out to that farmer in Missouri or wherever, you know, watching his way of life blow away in the wind and like, dude, you should have gone to MIT or something. But you see what I'm getting at? This is not a philosophy for reducing inequality. This is a philosophy for rationalizing inequality. It always pushes the blame back onto the individual. It's always your own goddamn fault. You screwed up in grade school. You dropped out of high school. You didn't go to college. Or maybe you did go to college, but you went to the wrong college. Or maybe you went to the right college, but you didn't study the right subject. Endless evasiveness. They can always push the blame back onto you. This is a philosophy of winners, folks. And the Democratic Party is a party that is concerned with winners. And that is our left party here in America today, a party of the new economy winners. I mean, there's a reason that Hillary Clinton's campaign was all about her resume, right, and her credentials. And she thought she could win by running as this kind of hyper-competent expert, friends with the Wall Street bankers and with the more enlightened sort of graduate students. Her unofficial slogan was, America is already great. I mean, it's like the kind of thing you'd see inscribed on a country club logo somewhere. This is, seriously, this is militant complacency is what this was. And look at where she did best. It's in the suburbs, right, the wealthy suburbs and in wealthy college towns and wiped out everywhere else. And This is happening all over the Western world. Everywhere you go, parties of the left are dispirited. They don't know what they believe in. They make things up. They spin these fantasies about globalization and innovation and the creative class. This is everywhere you go, folks. And working people are abandoning these parties by the millions. They're lining up with demagogues like Donald Trump, who at least pretend to understand the situation that they're in. Now, Trump himself, I think, will make an almost perfect epitaph for this era of professional class liberalism. I mean, he is the opposite of what Democrats respect. Hillary was supposed to be the most experienced presidential candidate of all time. Trump is the least. Zero. He has no government experience at all. He holds expertise in contempt. He is noticeably indifferent to facts. You know, in Washington, there's like the pundit class has the household god of Washington is bipartisanship, you know, consensus. And the Democrats, by and large, go along with that. Trump doesn't give a shit about consensus. He doesn't care. He is a human middle finger to the, you know. So all of these things that make up the Democratic vision of the presidency. Okay, so what is our response to this guy? What do we do about this guy? By the way, I feel considerably less threatened by him today than I did a few days ago. I mean, what kind of dictator is this, you know? He can't get his signature piece of legislation passed? Oh, my God. He's no Huey Long. Come on. All right, so what's our response to the age of Trump? Now, I know it is fun to sign up for the political wars. I have been there. And it is fun to joke about how stupid he is, and he is stupid. And it's fun to scold his clueless supporters, which I think is, by the way, not something that we ought to be doing. And it's also fun to imagine that the party divide in America is between righteousness and sin, and that the real battle is between enlightenment and ignorance. I think David Brooks actually said that the other day. But I can't help but think that the real answer, the correct answer to this phony right-wing populism that we've been living with all these decades, the real answer is to insist on the real deal, to show these Trump supporters that we care about them far more than this guy does, and that, yes, the system is rigged, and Trump's one of the guys that rigged it. Yeah. I mean, look. Populism by itself is a healthy thing. Suspicion of elites, hostility towards arrogance, hatred of aristocracy. Folks, those are good things. That's democracy. That's who we are in this country. And it's not hard to figure out the kind of populist issues that would bring working class voters I'm talking about back into the Democratic fold. Reindustrialization, how about that? A lot of Bernie's issues. Universal health care looks pretty good right now. Free college. How about antitrust enforcement? A lot of people would get behind that. How about making it easier to form unions in this country again? Yeah. And these are not radical proposals. In fact, you know how long it took me to think up that list? About 10 seconds. This is easy stuff, right? These are the same things that would win elections for Democrats and would reverse inequality, the slide towards inequality, the disintegration of the middle class society. The problem is not coming up with those things. That's easy. The problem is making our party commit to those things. The Democrats resist those things with everything they got. And they continue to resist them even right now, even to this day, even after that debacle last November. I mean, we are going to have to drag them kicking and screaming to victory. But until that happens, folks, we are going to, in this country, we're going to bounce on from government by one set of rich people to government by a different set of rich people. And your sort of consensus-minded Clintonism deregulates the banks and then yields to George W. Bush authoritarianism, who deregulates them some more, and then self-destructs, and the centrists get another chance, which they inevitably fumble, and so on, and so on, and so on. Where is this all going to end? Only when we, the people, come back for our party. Thank you very much. this? Do you want to call on people? How do you want to do it? I'll do it. Okay, yeah, so let's talk it over. You've had your hand up. I don't like your tie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frank, and I agree with a great deal of what you said, but if you need a devil's advocate, I propose to play it. Since the chair of the Monroe County Democratic Party,
is that here?
Mark Fraley, listened to you very meekly. I'm going to stand up for the Democrats for a moment.
I'm not here to embarrass anybody, folks. What I really want you to do is, we have copies of my book outside,
yes.
And we're going to put that damn thing on the bestseller list, and they're going to listen.
Indeed. Well, I would consider Mark to be one of us and not one of them. So I hope those of you who know him will give him a warm hand right now.
All right.
We have a very progressive party in this county. But what I want to ask you is two questions. I think you'll know, I'm putting them rather poetically, but I think you'll know what I mean.
Okay.
The first is, how many thousand years do you expect the thousand-year Reich to last? and my second question is, haven't you really greatly idealized the Democratic Party of Andrew Jackson, which was a profoundly racist party? Jackson is not a hero of working people if they don't happen to be white and male.
Okay, that's fair.
And
enough.
So Lyndon Johnson, as you will recall, when he signed the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act, said that the Democrats had lost the South for a generation.
Yeah.
And I share your critique of Wall Street, and I share your critique of Hillary spending the summer on the vineyard and all of that, but I think you also need to give the Democrats some credit for trying to be a multicultural party.
I push
back at the notion that this is all easy.
Yeah.
I think we have a profoundly complicated period of history to live through, skipping everything else, making the ecological transition is going to be profoundly difficult. And I just would call for a little more complexity and nuance presentation.
Exactly. Can I tell you why I do that? Why I talk about those, I fully acknowledge that everyone I referred to, Truman, Roosevelt, Johnson, Humphrey, these guys had a lot of problems, okay? That's just not my subject tonight. And I can list them as well as you can. Andrew Jackson, I mean, this guy had, I mean, yeah, the Trail of Tears, this is extremely bad. And that is not something to admire. The Jacksonian period, however, was a time of incredible democratic flowering. And you don't, I mean, that's where our movement begins. And that is separate from his race hatred of the Indians, which was incredible and, was exterminationist, was just loathsome. And, obviously not admirable. But the Jacksonian period was the time when, for the first time in the history of the world, there was no property qualification for voting. Average citizens, as long as you were white and male, got to vote, okay? And that would eventually be extended to everyone in this country. That was incredibly revolutionary. And that was not necessarily thanks to Jackson himself, that was just the man who became the symbol of the period. But that was Martin. You can just as easily say the era of Martin Van Buren, But the great book of this period, The Age of Jackson. I mean, there's many heroes in that time other than Jackson. A lot of them still very like Van Buren is still a very admirable man. By the way, the only American president whose first language was not English, it was Dutch. Yeah. Anyhow, so I don't mean to brush over, or paper over these people's flaws. You have to acknowledge them, of course. But what I want to concentrate now is the people we're living with now. And symbols have importance. Symbols are meaningful.
You have been listening to A Conversation with Thomas Frank on Standing Room Only on WFHB. been listening to author Thomas Frank give a lecture on his book tour for his book entitled Listen Liberals. Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Pity the Billionaire, and The Wrecking Crew, among with many others. Frank was brought to Bloomington on March 24th by Democracy for Monroe County. We return now to an audience member asking a question.
Got a question up front here.
Oh, Regina, hold on.
Rob's got one already. I'm sorry about that. She saw her hand. I didn't see you with it. Go ahead.
So first, I've lost my voice as well, and I have to confess, I'm an Ivy League trained doctor, so I'm one of...
I'm a part of this class that I criticize.
Yeah. And unlike my friend David, I'm going to try to simplify things a little, because I think this is a good day for it. So the party of the people, because I've got a lot of problems with the Democratic Party, and you gave a wonderful explanation of that tonight. I have no complaint, actually. So the Democratic Party, you know, had in their platform, starting with Harry Truman, universal health care. And you know who took it out?
Was it Clinton?
Clinton. Clinton took it out.
A bunch of things like that. A friend of mine studies the platforms, and it's amazing how it changed in 92.
Amazing what changed. Clinton strong-armed the platform committee.
They're also going to repeal Taft-Hartley. Do you remember that? And that also disappeared.
So Ronald Reagan, excuse me, how can I say that? Donald Trump... won the Indiana primary. Bernie Sanders won the Indiana primary. Both of those candidates ran, Bernie overtly, on single-payer Medicare for All. But Trump, from the 1990s on, has consistently said publicly and in writing that he favors universal health care. Now, he's in a political corner right now, but he has consistently said he favors universal health care. We're going to make it great. He later, just last year, started saying, well, I'm not talking about single payer, because the people within the party were pushing back on him. But it is, having universal health care is not a radical idea.
Right.
It is a core Democratic value. The Affordable Care Act was a very faulted bit of legislation. The American Health Care Act was obviously going to only make it worse. So obviously, before I go any further, I should just stop and turn it over to you and say your comments, please.
Oh, well, what can I say? You're exactly right. So I just came back from a tour of Australia and of Scandinavia, and the people there, you know, look at our healthcare system with horror. By the way, those countries are sort of like, it's as though, you know, they're very familiar in a lot of ways, especially Australia. They speak the same language. They have the same sort of attitude towards the world that we do. They hate aristocracy. Very democratic people. But they continue down the path that we diverted from back in the 1980s. And, like, you know, they have this wonderful healthcare system. By the way, and Scandinavia too, all of those countries. And none of these places are totalitarian holes. That's the fascinating thing about it. I was in Scandinavia, and you know, you're walking in like Sweden, and you're walking down the street, and it's like the most Stockholm. Man, this is a beautiful city. You know, this is a prosperous, wealthy society. I was the labor unions there have a resort, and I went to it was really nice, you know? And it's like, you know, like that Danish modern furniture that everyone was buying in the 60s. They still got all that. And they're like, and the walls, and they have this art that was painted recently, social realism, like paintings of workers and stuff. It's like, they're still doing it. They're like, and we took this crazy, you know, different course in this country. And sadly, now the whole world we're dragging everybody else along with us now. I mean, we're well down the road, you know, considerably farther than anybody else. And they're all, by the way, terrified of Trump. And terrified for two reasons. First, that he's unstable and will start a war. And second, that they're going to get their own Trump. And they can all see that coming. And I mean, what you say is exactly right, the healthcare thing. And by the way, Obamacare. There's a long section in the book where, not long, two or three pages where I tried to make sense of Obamacare. And what you finally realize is that all of the big things that Barack Obama did were all half measures. They were all compromises when he didn't really need to compromise. And Obamacare in particular was a compromise with the insurance companies and big pharma. And it's like, why? You know, why? He had, again, the world at his back. You know, the country expecting certain things from him. Anyhow, I've talked too much. Yes, ma'am.
I do have a question. Regarding the early 90s and maybe even, like you said, into the 80s, could you talk a little bit about the Democratic Leadership Council Conference and what impact that had on Clinton? Would Al Gore, would John Kerry have done the same things that Bill Clinton did and Barack Obama did in promising industries and not?
So when I talked about the groups, the reform groups in the Democratic Party fighting like cats and dogs, one of them was the Democratic Leadership Council. And this was a group of Southern, white Southern politicians set up in the 80s to drag the Democratic Party to the right. And that was their general focus. Their particular focus was Jesse Jackson, and they hated him, just hated him. And it was, you know, because it was in 88 that Jesse Jackson ran and actually did fairly well, pretty well in the primaries. And so the idea was to prevent that from ever happening again. And they teamed up with Bill Clinton. He became their leader. The rest is history, as they say. They went into the White House. They were his advisors. The Democratic Leadership Council doesn't exist anymore, but its leading lights are all over the place in Washington. You run into them all the time. They're columnists here, and they're advisors there, and they're senior, you know, spokesmen here, or whatever. By the way, one of their, and they have a huge amount of influence. There's many, many miniature versions of the Democratic Leadership Council all over Washington, and they really do still control the Democratic Party and all the sort of party machinery in Washington. One of the most interesting things about these guys, and I describe them at some length in the book because they really changed their focus enormously in their short lifetime. And by the end, they're exactly what I described, the professional class, creativity, all that crap. They were just churning that crap out by the end. But earlier on, they had this war on the word populism. And the idea was that Democrats should never be populists, should never think of themselves as populists, should never like embrace populism, that this was the kiss of death. And so their every effort went into, so every time a Democrat would lose, they would say, oh, that's because he was a populist. And every time a Democrat would win, they'd say, oh, that's because he's a new Democrat. And he understands the creative class or whatever, you know. And they did this all the time. And there are still Democrats out there that do this. And I used to fight with these guys. And I'd say, yes, and look, George W. Bush just won using populist themes. Or, you know, whoever, whatever politician it is. And you're depriving our guys of the tools that they need. Anyhow, that's who they are. They're still enormously powerful, although the organization itself doesn't exist. And and by the way, Al Gore was one of them. And Clinton was one, and Obama was not. Obama actually went out of his way to, this is one of the reasons I really liked Obama, went out of his way to insult them. But then once he was in office, I think he referred to himself as a blue dog or something like that. Remember that? What did he call himself? I mean, he immediately, you know, declared that he was a centrist, a new Democrat. He said, yes, I am a new Democrat too. So there you go, folks.
Since we're in Indiana, I want to talk about reindustrialization that you talked about. I don't, given the fact that we are in a high-tech technology, you know, and steel factory can be run by 5 or 10 people, how realistically are you going to reindustrialize Indiana? We're not going to have more coal mines. If we go out and try to convince our working class white people up in northern Indiana. I mean, what are you really going to tell them?
Well, I mean, look, Trump was right about the trade deals. That's first and foremost. Trump is wrong about the details. Trump doesn't really understand the trade deals. By the way, this is his number one issue. I was really surprised by this. His number one issue, he talked about it all the time. And if you just scratch the surface with this guy, it was clear he didn't really know what he was talking about at all, even though it's his number one issue. I'll give you an example. I'm sorry, I'm getting away from your subject. I'll come back to it. He was talking about what a bad trade deal NAFTA was. And it is, it's a bad deal. And then he says, you know, we got all these smart business executives in America. If we would just let them negotiate the trade deals, then they'd be really awesome. And it's like, don't you understand, Trump? I mean, it's like, that's who negotiated them. That's why they're so bad. So my friend, I have an economist friend in D.C., Dean Baker, who writes about this issue all the time, because there's a lot of people who say it's simply impossible to do that. And he says, look at the trade deficit. Look at the trade deficit in this country. It's mainly in manufacturing. I mean, we haven't always run a trade deficit. If you want to fix a trade deficit, that means you're going to have manufacturing in America. It's just math. You know, as you take on the trade deficit, manufacturing will start to happen here. And if you do fix the trade deals, you will see the sort of marginal enterprises not moving overseas. You know, and I happen to think that NAFTA was a terrible deal, and that the Trans-Pacific, so was the deal with China, which I'm forgetting the name of, PNTR or whatever it was called. A lot of these things were designed to deindustrialize the country. You undo them, and you'll have all sorts of unexpected results.
On Friday, March 24th, author Thomas Frank came to Bloomington to promote his book entitled Listen, Liberals. Frank talked about the modern Democratic Party, the essence of its philosophy, and how it has changed over the years. Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Pity the Billionaire, and The Wrecking Crew, among with many others. The lecture took place at the IU School of Education, and Democracy for Monroe County hosted the lecture.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.